This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good morning. Thank you for coming. You're as bad as my still hold you are my students. Actually, I love the energy you can feel in a room. You get all these people together, and if we said nothing, you could have a fun time sitting here talking and doing science all on your own. But we're going to say some things. And it's my pleasure today to be able to introduce our speaker. And I want to first thank Zurich Financial Services, who provided the endowment that allows this to be a regular feature at Bren, where we bring in outstanding scholars who come in and stimulate and challenge us with their ideas. And I'm sure that's going to happen today with Steve Plaske. I've known Steve for 16 years because I was on the search committee that hired him at University of Minnesota 16 years ago. And although he's in economics, I got him an office down the hall in the ecology building. And we've been wonderful collaborators and friends ever since. He's an amazing, amazing scholar. His background, a PhD in economics and a bachelor's in economics and some time at the London School of Economics, a very good academic pedigree. I think one of the various things he's done, which is having a large global impact, he was a co-founder of a project called the Natural Capital Project. So organisms as capital in the sense of an economist, and how we can better use the biological capital of the earth and benefit from it. Among his many honors, probably the most noted one would be that he is an elected member of the National Academy of Science. I believe of all the economists at the University of Minnesota, it's only our environmental economist who's actually in that August organization. So we're very delighted for that. He's going to talk to us today. And you may have heard the song playing as you came in by Paul Simon, which I won't even dare to sing, since even when I sing in the shower, dogs down the street are howling. But it's titled, What Are You Going to Do About It? The Effect of Uncertainty on Climate Change Policy. Steve.
So thanks very much for inviting me and for being here this morning. I've been wrestling with issues. Mostly, I wrestle with issues, as Dave said, on ecosystem services and natural capital, and what we do to the natural world and what it brings for us in terms of our welfare. But for a variety of projects, obviously you can't avoid climate change, and it's come up again and again in my work. And so the thing that I really wanted to talk to you about was this notion of, we don't know exactly what climate change is going to bring. We don't know how it's going to affect the natural world. We don't know how it's going to affect human systems. But that doesn't stop us from trying to take actions to either reduce the severity of climate change or to adapt to climate change. So the what are you going to do about it actually is at two levels. The first is the obvious level of, well, what policy are we actually going to do? But the other level of what are you going to do about it is at the level of how do you even think about what the right level or right approach to policy is when there's this profound uncertainty about things. But I have to admit that the title came to me really from the song. So this is a Paul Simon song. And it always runs through my head, so what are you going to do about it? That's what I'd like to know. And that's what we're going to try to get to. But I actually went, for this talk, I went back and looked at the lyrics ahead of it. And I realized it says, hey, breakdowns come and breakdowns go. And I was thinking of the UN climate change process and leading up to Paris. So what are you going to do about it? That's what I'd like to know. Okay, so the real question here for climate change policy is first and foremost is mitigation. So how are we going to limit the emissions of greenhouse gases? That's primarily an energy use question, but there's also land use and agriculture elements and other things, but primarily an energy use question. So how are we going to reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere? It's also an adaptation question. There's no doubt that there is already some warming kind of baked into the system. We are going to have to adapt. And these are related. If you don't do as much mitigation, you're going to have to do more adaptation. But I will primarily be talking about mitigation here. How would we provide advice to policymakers on mitigation and adaptation? Now, the other thing I should preface this set of talks or this set of remarks with is that that you actually presume that you have receptive policymakers who want to hear this message, and of course that's a questionable. That's quite uncertain as well. But we're going to go forward with that. So, you know, what should we be doing on climate change policy? And I actually am fairly optimistic that there will be a time when we actually do have a reasoned debate on this and take steps forward. Okay, so the answer to what advice or what should we be doing about climate change depends upon how serious the consequences of future climate change are likely to be. The future consequences are uncertain. So that brings me back to this notion of how do we incorporate uncertainty and how do we provide good policy advice when we don't know exactly what the future consequences are likely to be. I think it's really interesting. So one of the people I'm going to be talking, whose work I'm going to be talking a lot about is Bill Nordhaus, an economist at Yale who's written for decades on climate change. His most recent book on climate change is called The Climate Casino. And I'll let you read the quote here, but I think it's really interesting that this is a quote actually from page one of his book. So he's thinking a lot about how do we deal with these changes which are unforeseeable and perhaps dangerous. We are rolling the climatic dice, and the outcome will produce surprises, and some of them are likely to be perilous. Right? So uncertainty and the potential for large shocks, large negative impacts is out there. How do we think about policy advice in that context? Okay, so very quickly, what are some of the uncertainties? Where do uncertainties enter in? And for your information, this is Katrina swirling in the Gulf before it slammed into New Orleans. The first uncertainty comes in how high will greenhouse gas emission concentrations in the atmosphere go, or how high will the greenhouse gas concentrations go? As a function of how much is in the atmosphere, what's the climate response called climate sensitivity? Then even if we knew that, what are the impacts going to be? What are the physical impacts? How much sea level rise would there be? What are the impacts on storms? And then what are the damages? So if we're thinking about costs to avoid more stringent climate change or more severe climate change, how do we balance those against potential damages from future climate change? And how do we think about the right policy then? So again, the direct policy question is how much mitigation should we be doing and how much should we be adapting to climate change? And as I said, the higher order policy question is on what basis do we provide that advice given uncertainty? Well, one way to do uncertainty is what this man is doing, throwing darts blindfolded. Hopefully we can do a bit better than that. So I'm going to talk a bit about a decision science approach where you focus or concentrate on probabilities and consequences. So how likely are certain events and what are the benefits and costs of those certain outcomes occurring? And then there's another approach, a threshold approach, where basically you think about what is dangerous climate change, set a threshold, and take actions to make sure that you don't go over those thresholds. So I'll talk about both of those approaches and in the end come back and try to summarize how I think about them. And these just to put a human face, I talked about Nordhaus at the beginning, but to put a human face on both of these approaches. So within the economics community, providing advice to policymakers on climate change, you have Nicholas Stern from Great Britain, who's very much, I'd argue, an advocate for setting boundaries or safe limits, kind of the threshold approach. And Bill Nordhaus, who I've already mentioned, who takes a much more decision science approach. Let's work on an integrated climate and economics model and think about balancing the benefits and the costs through our actions. Okay, so just to provide kind of a roadmap, I'm going to talk about the major sources of uncertainty, go back, I just mentioned them earlier, talk about this framework, so the threshold approach versus the decision science approach, and then come back and really bring this back to the question of providing climate change policy advice. Okay, so major sources of uncertainty, and there certainly are large ones. So this is from the latest IPCC report on climate, on projections. You can see that the range of possible outcomes here, partly depending upon our own actions, of course, how much we decide as a society to limit or mitigate emissions versus not. But you can see, you know, we might be anywhere between 1 degree centigrade rise and possibly 4, 5, 6 degrees centigrade rise. Okay, so what are the sources of uncertainty? Well, I've already mentioned the first one here, projecting the future path of greenhouse gas emissions, right? This depends upon our policies. It depends upon technology. If solar keeps falling in price, it may not be a function of policy, but may be a function of choices of firms and individuals to switch to renewable sources. Second source here, estimating the impacts of once we know what's in the atmosphere, what are the climate impacts, this climate sensitivity point. Again, then the third, you know, once we know what climate is, how does that translate into physical effects? How much is sea level going to rise? What's the change in storm intensity? What's this change in precipitation by region and so forth? And finally, what's the value of those impacts? So in terms of future emissions, we do know some. We know we can look and see what the trajectory of emissions has been. Where it's going to go in the future is partly a function of our own policy, so there's sort of a feedback. How aware are we? How serious do we take this problem? That will affect policy and energy and emissions. But there's also something which is somewhat out of our control, of course, which is the question of feedbacks. So suppose that we don't take much action and we warm the world, and particularly we warm much of the northern parts, which are right now frozen with permafrost. So those permafrost that starts to melt leads to a lot of methane emissions. Methane emissions lead to more warming, which leads to further melting and so forth. So there are these feedback effects even in just thinking about what the future emissions are going to be. The feedback effects are also really important in this next stage, thinking about the climate system response. So we know the physics of the direct warming, so how the sunlight comes in, how much of that is retained, bounced back into outer space as a function of the greenhouse effect. What we know less about are some of the feedbacks. So what happens in a warmer world? Does that lead to more clouds at certain levels? How does that affect the amount of radiative forcing? And there was a very nice paper back a few years ago in Science that talked about how if you can't really pin down this feedback effect, so on the horizontal axis here is uncertainty about one of these feedback effects, there is a response between the feedback effect and the change in temperature, which is on the vertical axis. So if you have this relationship, which is the line, that convex line going up, convex curve, then you can see what the predictions will be or the range of predictions will be in terms of change in temperature. So the problem here is that with this kind of relationship and with the uncertainty on this feedback effect, it may be really difficult to ever get precise estimates about what the future change in global mean temperature are going to be. And you'll note on this that there's a really long, here it's upward tail, I would call it rightward tail normally, but upward tail on the possible temperature changes. Okay. I think, and maybe this is my personal bias because I tend to work on models that are at the intersection of ecosystems and human systems, but even if you know the global mean temperature, what you really need to do to translate this something to back to the impacts to people, we need to translate this into what effects are happening regionally. And that may be temperature, but it may be precipitation. It may be not just total amount of precipitation, but in what form does it come? Does it come in snow? Does it come in rain? And how does that then impact upon various things that people care about? So sea level rise or agricultural productivity or exposure to storms and more severe storms. And then finally, how do we think about what the value of those impacts? How damaging is future climate change going to be? And that's a function not only of the physical impacts, but also what we choose to do about it. So if we are smart and adapt and plan well, we can reduce impacts, say, from sea level rise compared to cases where we just ignore it and we continue to put ourselves in harm's way. Okay, so there's a number of sources of uncertainty, and obviously I'm just giving you the surface of this, not going into any depth on it. But what I really want to do is taking that uncertainty, both the biophysical as well as the economic and social sources of uncertainty, and think about how that affects what we're going to do about it. What does that mean for policy and decision-making related to climate change? Okay, so as I said at the beginning, I'm going to focus on two approaches, kind of classic approaches to decision-making under uncertainty. One is what's called decision science approach, where you really focus on setting an objective and thinking about probabilities and consequences. The other is thinking about setting safe limits, worrying about where thresholds are and not crossing thresholds. Both of these have been talked about a great deal, not only in climate change, but throughout environmental policy. Okay, so again, the decision sciences approach really emphasizes it's about probabilities. How likely is an outcome to occur? And consequence, what are the net benefits, benefits and costs of a particular outcome? So, you know, how likely is it that temperature would rise to 6 degrees change C from where we are now? And if it does rise to that high, how large are the damages? So probabilities, consequences. Okay, so I'm just going to walk through this approach. Some of you this will be very familiar with, others maybe less so. One nice thing about the decision science approach is it forces you to be very clear about what your objective is. What are the net benefits or what are you trying to accomplish? So I've written down. So the bullet points in the high level are going to be kind of the general thing about decision science approach. The things underneath it with the dashes are the example that I'm going to use in relating this to climate change. So one possible approach to setting the objective is to minimize the expected mitigation costs and expected damages from climate change. Okay, so I'll call that sort of a classic maximization problem, maximizing net benefits, or here called minimizing the costs associated with climate change. But you can do other things. I mean, one approach here is a maximin approach. Let's try to avoid the worst possible outcome. So let's choose the actions that are going to give us the highest worst outcome, if you will, right? So maximin. Okay. So once you specify the objective, you also need to know what policy levers you have. So what actions can you take? In the simple example I'm going to give you in a moment, I'll think about three potential ways forward. So one, no mitigation, kind of a moderate mitigation approach, and a stringent mitigation approach. Okay. Again, probabilities, consequences. So we need to define uncertainty or the probability of various states occurring or various outcomes occurring. And so in the example I'll talk about, suppose that we really do have high climate sensitivity or medium or low climate sensitivity. And then what the probability in this approach really does is it combines both kind of the states of nature, like how does the physical system actually respond, for which we may be uncertain, as well as how does that combine with our own actions to form a probability of a particular outcome occurring. Okay? And then the last part, so probabilities, consequences, we need to know what the net benefits of different outcomes are. So what are the costs associated with various levels of climate change damage or with mitigation cost? And then let's choose the action which goes back to our objective and does the best given what our objective is. Okay, so let me give you a specific example instead of talking in abstract generalities. So let's think about, again, there's three actions that you could advise a government to take. You could have stringent control, really ratchet down on climate change emissions, so reduce energy use or switch to renewables, be very aggressive about this. There's a moderate control of emissions, and then there's no action, just let things go. Okay? And then suppose that there are three, quote, states of nature, three physical states of the world. So one is, suppose that the skeptics are right, that the climate change is not a problem. Okay, so that's the, quote, zero damage column. There's a low climate sensitivity column, so I've called that the low damage one, and then there's a high damage one. And you'll note the numbers here are made up, but there's a logic here, which is that the high damage, if you don't do anything, you get really high losses, right? So, but on the other hand, if climate change isn't really a problem, then doing stringent control is quite costly, doing moderate control is not that costly, and doing no control has no cost at all, okay? So what should you do? Well, what you should do is depends upon, first of all, what your objective is. Here I'm going to try to minimize expected damages, I can't really minimize expected damages unless I know something about the probabilities of these various potential states of the world. So I don't put much stock in the climate denialists, so I put a 0% on the zero damage column. And let's just put 50%, 50%. And it's not hard then to do the calculation. You just take the average between that second and third column, and you can figure out that the way to minimize cost under this example would be to do the moderate control, right? That gives you the least damage or the least cost, which is both damage and mitigation expenses. Okay? Okay, so that's just a very straightforward way of thinking about how to proceed with climate change policy. Tell them to minimize damages, minimize expected damages. Now, there's critics of this approach, and one criticism of this approach is, again, if you don't know very much about the system, and you don't really know what these probabilities are, unfortunately, in most systems, the answer that you give is sensitive to these probabilities. So let's just change the probabilities from 50-50 to 30-70. What do you get? Well, now it's best to take stringent control, not moderate control. So a little bit more weight on that high damage outcome. You want to take more stringent action. Okay, so in general, critics of this kind of decision science approach would say, what do you do if you don't really know the probabilities? There's also another criticism, which is, what do you do if you don't really know the possible outcomes, right? I just had a really simple example, three possible outcomes, but, you know, with climate change, the, quote, state space is really large, right? So how are we going to know what everything can be that's out there? So one way of thinking about it is the following. So, you know, really simple problems where there's no uncertainty. There's not many of those, especially in environmental space. There's the problem of, what do you do if you know all the it's uncertain, but you know all the probabilities. I think most people would argue in that case, going ahead with decision science approach is a very straightforward way of handling the problem. But what if you're outside of that realm? What if you don't know what the probabilities are? Okay, so this is the imaginable uncertainty, known consequences, but unknown probabilities. And then there's the even larger space out there of unimaginable uncertainty. You don't know what all the consequences are or what all the potential things that could happen out there, and you certainly don't know what the probabilities are. Okay? So there's actually people who've said this more eloquently, but I find this better for humor value. So as we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know. Anyway. And the sick part is that I know what he's talking about. okay, so you know, it's really that diagram that we were talking about before. So again, with known probabilities and you know all the possible events, I think that decision science approach is that's the way I would go. What do you do if you don't know the probabilities? So now you need a different, somewhat of a different approach. And you know, one approach that people would say, well, you can always assign subjective probabilities. Use the best information you have, make a guess as what the probabilities are, and then proceed as we did before. Some people are unwilling to do that. So what about approaches that don't use the probabilities, that just think about the consequences? Okay, so one example of this is what I referred to before, is the maxi-min rule. So choose a decision that maximizes the worst possible or minimum outcome. So again, going back to our simple example, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen? Well, the worst thing that can happen is it truly turns out that we are in the high damage world. And in that kind of world, the worst, you know, if I have stringent control, then I get a score or payoff of minus 11, and you can see the other one. So under a maxi-min approach, here the recommendation would be a stringent control. Okay? So that's what you can do, you know, if you don't want to assign probabilities. There are other approaches that people have suggested, maxi-min regret and other kinds of things. But I want to spend just a second about what do you do with these quote unknown unknowns. You don't even know what's going to happen, right? There are sort of true surprises out there. And unfortunately, you know, there's not a great answer here. It's like, if you don't really know very much, then you're not really going to be very good at providing advice. But my advice would be, do the best you can. And first and foremost, what that means is thinking expansively about what the potential outcomes are. So get out of the box as much as possible and think about where things might happen, right? So you're trying to reduce the space of surprises as much as possible. And once you have done this, you can go ahead and, you know, assign probabilities or go forward. But the real point here is, you know, you really ought to be investing in creative thinking and the science, which will tell you about what are the large potential surprises in the system, right? Because you want to eliminate, you know, you don't want to be surprised, wake up someday, and all of a sudden realize that the world is very, very different than you expected and that it has a really bad outcome for you. Okay. So there's been kind of in this arena, there have been many people who have focused then on this kind of potential for nasty surprises. And clearly these systems that we're dealing with, human systems and climate systems and combined human and climate systems, which are very complex, it's very hard to make predictions. So there are going to be surprises in such systems. And that's led some people to take a different approach to decision-making or advice to decision-makers. So this threshold approach, and some of you probably familiar with the Rockström et al. Paper in Nature, where they basically were trying to set a safe, you know, sort of safe limits or safe operating space for humanity in a number of different dimensions, one of which is climate change. And so, you know, if there is the potential for these thresholds, can we really just focus then, the threshold approach will just focus on where are those thresholds or tipping points likely to be, and let's then try to avoid crossing those critical thresholds. Okay, so here is a paper, or results from, from a paper by Tim Lenton and co-authors in PNAS from 2008 that talks about major potential tipping points, some of these large-scale events that could occur in a climate system, and we ought to be paying attention to these. So it's everything from, you know, the Arctic Sea melting, dieback in the Amazon, and you can see there's not a huge number of these, but there are a significant number of potential tipping points that they focused on. Okay, so the threshold approach then is to delineate where these critical thresholds might be and focus on avoiding them. In the climate change arena in particular, then some people have said, well, can we specify what dangerous climate change might be, and can we then avoid going over it? So many people have focused on this 2 degrees C warming as basically a bound, that we don't want to cross over that in order to avoid setting up some of these nasty surprises or crossing some of these critical thresholds. Okay. One criticism of threshold approach is, do we really know where they are? In fact, you know, many people were quite critical of the Rockström et al. Paper by saying, you know, how do we know where the safe operating space for humanity actually is? And if we don't know exactly where it is, then I think we're back into this world of saying, you know, if we reduce how much we're going to allow carbon to build up in the atmosphere, that would probably reduce the probability of crossing these thresholds, but it would come at an increased cost. So how do we think about those kinds of trade-off risk or cost-risk trade-offs? And that really puts us back into the decision science realm. The other quick point on this, people have criticized thresholds as saying that below the threshold it's sort of safe. You can you know, pollute without consequence up to a threshold, and then, you know, and then all hell breaks loose, and then after that there's no more value because everything's dead, you know. So it's obviously a too simplistic view of how things actually operate. Okay, but so there, again, I want to set up these sort of two approaches, the decision science approach and the thresholds approach. Now I want to come back to climate change policy. So why is all this relevant for climate change policy? So within the economics community, there's been a vigorous debate going on, and more generally in the climate science community, about how should we be thinking about mitigating greenhouse gas emissions. And on the left is Nick Stern, and I'm sort of pigeonholing him in the threshold camp, and on the right is Bill Nordhaus, and talking about him in terms of decision science. Okay, I'll try to back that up. I think it's pretty clear that Nordhaus belongs in the sort of decision science benefit cost approach. His advice coming out of that is for modest rates of emission reductions in the near term, followed by more stringent policy as time goes on. So how does he get there? So some of you are familiar with his work. He's been at this now for quite some time. he wrote a book in 2000 called Warming the World and laid out the basics of his DICE model, or Dynamic Integrated Model of Climate and the Economy. And basically, as it says, what this is a it's a fairly simple economic model, which is dynamic. It follows the evolution of the economy through time. So you think about savings and investment, and how does that lead to changes in capital stock, and how does that lead to changes in income and output through time. Emissions are related to how large the economy is and how much you devote of output to mitigating emissions. And then the emissions go up into to the atmosphere. You have both an atmosphere and coupled ocean systems model. It's a very simple climate model. But then climate change comes back to affect the economy by reducing economic output. Okay, so that's a very quick thumbnail sketch of the DICE model. He uses this then to say, well, how could we evaluate alternative approaches to mitigating climate emissions, greenhouse gas emissions? And that's where he comes up with this moderate approach, or moderate action now, followed by more stringent action later on. Most of the reason for this is as follows. Technological change will lower costs of taking mitigation in the future, as well as the fact that, the first bullet point is that, you know, if you force anybody to do something really rapidly, it's going to be very costly. And a number of studies have found that, you know, the costs of reducing emissions fall with the longer you allow people the planning period or adjustment period to doing it. So, and the last one, basically, and I'm not going to talk about this, people have thought about how we should think about discounting and intergenerational equity questions, but essentially in the Nordhaus model, they're going to be rich in the future, so let them deal with it. Okay, so it's interesting to note, though, that this approach would not limit emissions to 550 parts per million. We'd be going somewhere north of that. Okay, but again, Nordhaus balancing costs and benefits and using this integrated climate and economy model in order to come up with predictions about how the system would respond under alternatives. Okay, on the other hand, Stern, Nick Stern, basically said, you know what? We need to limit emissions to no more than doubling pre-industrial revolution levels. So 550 parts per million and no, you know, not going anywhere above that. We then figure out, well, what's the kind of best way of getting to that, of reducing our, you know, making sure that we don't go over that threshold. It's interesting to note, again, that many would say, well, the threshold's too high and you haven't been stringent enough. But among economists, Stern has been criticized for being too stringent. I mean, so he's much more stringent than Nordhaus was. Okay. So what Stern says, and I'll let you read his words, the gist of them is that the costs of not doing anything could be really high. The costs of taking action, while significant, are much lower. And we really need to take actions that will keep us within this 550 parts per million CO2 threshold. If we go above that, the costs may become astronomically or catastrophically high. So we need to avoid that. Okay. Some of you who know this literature know that when the Stern Review came out at the end of 2006 and follow-on reports and so forth in 2007, and Stern wrote a paper in 2008 from which this quote is taken from. But many people critiqued the Stern review. Nordhaus was one of them and was particularly critical, saying it was really more of a political document than an economic, credible economic analysis. So this is Stern firing back. So Stern's review of Nordhaus, as I have argued, it's very hard to believe that these kinds of models that Nordhaus is doing are going to give you sensible answers. In the middle here, I'd just like to emphasize, you know, it's risk and where risk and uncertainty are of the essence, and where many crucial economic, social, and scientific features are poorly understood, right? So that's, he's saying, that's really the crux of this. We really can't use these models credibly to come up with optimal answers in the sense that Nordhaus was doing. Okay, one more piece of the puzzle. So one more economist to throw at you, Martin Weitzman from Harvard, who weighed in here and in typical Weitzman fashion said, well, you're kind of both wrong. But he said, Stern Review, the policy advice from the Stern Review is probably right, but for the wrong reason. Okay, so why? So he wrote a paper in 2009. Some of you, again, maybe quite know this. I always wanted to write a paper where I got to name something like the Dismal Theorem. But the Dismal Theorem, maybe something happier, I don't know. Basically, he showed under certain circumstances that basically we would be willing to spend everything that we had, all of our income, in order to avoid the gamble of which the climate change gamble, which potentially involves catastrophic losses. Okay, so how does this work? Again, the simple intuition about this is if you think about that tail of the temperature going off to the right, going up high as 10, 15, 20 degrees C increase, and potentially huge losses associated with going that high, then basically you can get large or infinite losses. So you combine, in his model, a constant relative risk aversion, which basically means that you have unbounded losses as consumption goes to zero, so you get infinite losses. If the probability of that is high enough, then you would pay everything to avoid that outcome. That's the Dismal Theorem. Now, I can't, you know, there were stupid pet tricks. There's sort of tricks with infinity. I don't really know what to make of this as follows. So your own Chris Costello and I and Andy Solo Mike Newbert, thank you, wrote a paper where we basically said, look, if you cut off the maximum, and we went pretty darn high, 50 degrees C increase. I think nobody is really thinking we're going that high. You don't get everything as a loss. The vertical axis is how much you would be willing to spend out of income in order to avoid this gamble. And you can see, these are substantial, but it's not everything. I think the real point here is it's not that Weitzman was deliberate in choosing how he wrote this. What he was really after was saying that there's a troubling aspect here, which is that there is a potential for really, really large negative consequences, right? Catastrophic consequences. And even if those are small in probability, you're going to weight those very heavily and try to avoid them as much as possible. So the hard thing for going back to trying to put this into a decision context or decision science context is that low probability events in situations which are very different from what we have observed in the past or observe right now are kind of by definition going to be difficult to accurately predict. So you've got these things which are, kind of the tail that's wagging the dog. You don't really know how likely they are. So then for a policymaker, what do you do about that? So I'm not going to leave you totally hanging, although this is a talk about uncertainty, so I do have to leave you somewhat hanging. clearly the inclusion of uncertainty will increase the desired stringency of the policy. How much is very sensitive to how you model these catastrophic events or crossing thresholds, if you will. My own ballpark guess is I think somewhere like Weitzman, I think somewhere in the Stern range of policy advice is more sensible given this potential than where Nordhaus is. But that's a guess. I don't really know. And then in terms of the kind of approach, so I deliberately set this up as decision science versus a threshold. My own preference is decision science, but I have to say that if there are these potential for large catastrophic events, both methods will actually give you fairly similar results. If there's something out there, if you really know that there's going to be something that's really bad, then either approach will advise you to avoid it unless it's, you know, impossible or extremely costly to do so. So, you know, I think in the end, the last, you know, the point here is I think that the tools that economists have used aren't broken without possibility of repair, but I think they have ignored this possibility for very large negative events, and including those then would... wow, there's a negative event. I don't think I did that. but anyway, then that's a that's going to argue much more for stringent policy. Now, the last word that I want to say is it's not only how we think about this as scientists and advice that we provide, but you know, how is this heard? And learning to communicate this uncertainty, and unfortunately, coming back to the real world here, in a highly charged political debate with strong entrenched positions, this is a real difficulty. And some of you are familiar with a book called Merchants of Doubt by Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway, where you know, it's kind of the intersection between uncertainty and the politics of this that make some of the actual policy making in climate change so difficult. So with that, I will stop, and happy to take questions, remaining time. You going to moderate?
I'm going to moderate. You can choose any random hand, especially with Matt's.
What's that? Okay, Matt.
So I'm wondering, have any of these...
Matt, please use a microphone.
...who are part of this debate, have they... started considering some of the recent literature, some of which Dave has done, that sort of shows that there's this synergy with health and climate change mitigation. And I thought that there was a study, it was either by the IMF or the OECD maybe, that suggested that the health impacts might be sufficiently beneficial economically to offset some of the costs, if not all the costs in some places. So is that something that's entered the conversation among economists?
So this is
debate?
What the health impacts?
So the idea is that the actions that are good for mitigating climate change are also good for health. So things
yes.
like eating less red meat, less pollution, and healthcare is really expensive. And so the idea is that if you have to spend less on health, yeah. then maybe that offsets the cost of the mitigation.
Yeah, so there have been a number of studies that have done kind of what are called the ancillary benefits of taking actions for climate change. I didn't have it in this talk, but there's a great cartoon of, like, you know, what if climate change turns out to be a hoax and we, you know, cleaned up the world for nothing, you know? you know, you burn coal, which is obviously a huge climate change impact, but it's also got mercury, NOx, SOx, mountaintop mining, acid drainage problems. So there are a number of other impacts. And many people on the politics side have argued that what you would want to do for some of these things is, you know, if you're stuck on climate change, you can argue in terms of health benefits, clean air, so forth, that you should take some of these actions anyway. Some of them would matter. So even without adding in the climate change, some of these actions would make sense for society to do. So, yeah. Chris?
Steve, thanks for a great talk. Is this on? Here.
Anyway, thanks for a great talk, Steve. I have a question about, you didn't talk much about adaptation, but I have a question
yep.
about this, because I think your talk raised another dilemma about whether we should be mitigating or waiting and adapting. Because, and I'm just wondering about what you think about the following. So if we're uncertain about if there will be effects, where there will be effects, what the effects will be, but eventually they will unfold,
right.
then in a sense, if you wait, then you can adapt in exactly the right way. You can really hit it hard over here, but not over there, because that's where the effects were. What, is that a logical argument, and does that sort of deflate the whole idea of mitigation?
Okay, so it doesn't deflate it, but it certainly, it doesn't say you don't want to do anything, but there is an argument for, you know, if you're going to figure out whether something's serious or not. So, you know, if it turns out not to be serious, you would have rather not done something. So that there's one argument there. So if you reduce, you know, realize the uncertainty. But that particular argument can work both ways, right? Because now you put up the carbon into the atmosphere, it's going to be really hard to get it back if you wanted to undo it. But there is an argument, and Charlie Kolstad wrote about this, where there is a reason, you know, if you're going to learn, and especially if adaptation is going to turn out to be cheaper or easier, you'll push it. I actually think Nordhaus has a lot of, he doesn't particularly have that specific argument in it, but there is this sort of feel like they are going to be wealthier. You know, the margin utility of income to them is less, so we will let them deal with it more. In a sense, we'll let them adapt to it rather than us mitigate. But no, it's a good point. There are a lot of subtleties here. And you know, in the environmental community, many people don't want to talk about adaptation because of the dampening effect it would have on mitigation. Yeah, so it's a good point. Yeah.
So you were talking a bit about Weitzman and also your paper together with Chris. And it's been a while since I read that, but I mean, so the substantive point that I've taken from Weitzman is it's not just the distribution of temperatures, it's the damages
yes.
at each point
yes.
along that distribution. And he might have framed his argument in terms of learning about climate sensitivity and what, you know, so I see you put a threshold of 50. But, and yep. you've spoken about multiple uncertainties. And do you think that the important thing is not so much constraining what the distribution of temperatures, but that second layer of uncertainty is, you know, the damages at each point? Do you think that's a fair interpretation of what he's
yeah.
putting forward?
I think it's a really good point. Again, remember, it's really what you really care about is not just the temperature, but you care about the damages. So, you know, if you had catastrophic damages that were going off to minus infinity at 20 degrees C, which is not unreasonable, you know, then his argument, even if we cap it at 50, well, you still might get infinite losses below that. So you're exactly right. I mean, the real point which he was trying to raise, now I could criticize him, and I guess we did, for being kind of grabbing attention, but the real point is right, which is you have to pay attention to these potentially large events. And what can you say about how likely or unlikely are they? And if they're, you know, in the range of possibility, so even if you think, you know, if 6 degrees rise, I mean, that's a pretty scary thing. And if you think there's really large damages associated with that, then I think the Weitzman argument comes into play. It doesn't say spend everything. And, you know, later on, Weitzman said, I didn't really mean that. But, you know, but he was emphasizing the point that the models that have been done to date, including the Nordhaus models, are too much about central tendencies and not about the distribution. So you're right. You know, what's the temperature rise, but also what's the damage at that temperature rise? So it's a good point. Yes. Yeah.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah. How do you provide advice if the physical scale or the temporal scale of costs and benefits isn't the same as that of governance or decision-making?
Yeah. You'd have to invite me back for another talk on that. But it's, you know, the question, and actually this is something that in another hat, I do a lot of game theory. And so, you know, the question here is, you know, climate change is the classic free rider problem. You've got one country or one small scale taking actions to benefit the whole of humanity. How likely are they to do that? We've seen not very likely. So the question then is, how do you actually implement something which approaches kind of what's good for the globe as a whole? That's the point of having international negotiations. Now, they haven't been very successful, as we know, but you know, you have to have some way of internalizing the externalities or some agreement. you know, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change has been, you know, it's hard to get two people to agree, and much less 192 countries to agree. And so that looks like it's pretty damning. On the other hand, we've done some work on others. If you really focus on the key players, and who are the key players? It's the U.S., it's China. Right there, you've got 45% of global emissions. You throw in the EU, Japan, Russia, India, and you're up to around 60 to 70%. If you could get those key players to agree to take something in their mutual interest, you know, that's going to be a core of the problem. You combine that with kind of what Nordhaus actually talked about, what he called a climate club. So, you know, if you want to trade with the U.S. or the EU or China, then you also have to adopt these policies. And, you know, if you're Saudi Arabia and you know that exporting oil to the U.S. is going to result in the U.S. putting a tariff, a carbon tax on the oil and the U.S. collecting the money, why not you as Saudi Arabia collect the money yourselves instead of just giving that away to the U.S.? So there are some suggestions out there for handling this kind of global externality problem. But you're, you know, in terms of the real politics of it, that is the essence of the problem. Yep.
Yeah. Okay, we have time. Am I on?
Yes. For one or two more questions. So you, first here.
I was interested to see the Prime Minister of India explain 2 weeks ago that his policy was include us out in going for more use of coal for the next 10 years. Between Nordhaus on the higher end and the adaptationist, where would you put Rupert Murdoch's favorite merchant of doubt, your colleague Bjorn Longborg?
Oh, he's, yeah. He's way out there on the, I don't know if he would go as far as the people who say it's not a problem at all. But I think he, you know, he has made the argument that why would you spend a lot of money to address a problem that's going to happen in the future when we have many problems today?
Yeah. One last question.
Okay.
Thank you, Steve. It was very, very, very interesting presentation. So I think that what Dave asked was really the key. How can we bound the uncertainty as our science, our understanding progresses? Because, you know, whenever there is something infinite, you know, rational decision doesn't really play any role there.
Right.
And I think it reminded me of the debate back in Europe when I was trained there when GMO came out. And we don't hear that very much in the United States, but in Europe, whenever there is an environmental issue emerging, we always talk about precautionary principle, right? So precautionary principle is basically that, well, if there is unknown unknowns and huge uncertainties, that you have to always assume the worst case. And in our case, in climate change, worst case is basically disastrous, basically losing everything, right? In that case, I think that this is not a scientific problem where the rational decision-making plays a role there, I think. So how do you view the precautionary principle plays or does not play a role in the realm of decision-making in climate change?
Yeah, okay. So, you know, one thing is that none of these decisions are purely science decisions. I mean, these are like risk-cost trade-offs or benefit-cost trade-offs. So there's always going to be an element of value judgment or subjectivity in them. It's just unavoidable. But where about the precautionary principle? You know, I always find it, I actually find it a little, I find the precautionary principle a little bit difficult in the following sense. It's, you know, if I really took the precautionary principle seriously, I don't think I'd leave my house, you know. So, you know, because I might get run over, I mean, or something. But I think the element of the precautionary principle from which I'm sympathetic with and was kind of in this argument is if there are really bad outcomes that could happen, you need to take those seriously and do the best science that you can to try to bound that. And then it's a, you know, once you've done your sort of due diligence about what are the potential really nasty surprises out there, then I think it's a more reasoned debate about, okay, what are the likely risks? How do we weigh those relative to costs? and you make a decision. So the part that I'm sympathetic with is, you know, thinking, doing the good science in the first place to really try to remove that element of surprise as much as possible.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Steve.
Thank you all.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.